This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. People have been migrating to Vermont for thousands of years. The Abenaki developed extensive trade routes in the state and beyond its borders. European colonists and explorers first made their way here in the 1600s, and in the 1700s, European and other settlers colonized the state. But the big push of immigrants came after the American Revolution in the 18 and early 1900s. There were Irish, Poles, Russian Jews, Italians, Finns, Swedes, and Greeks, not to mention French Canadians and many others. They came looking for jobs in the marble and granite industry, the textile mills, manufacturing plants. Many took over abandoned farms. The draw? A better life than what they left behind. Today on the program, we'll talk about the trends that pushed thousands of immigrants to Vermont, what kind of life they led here, and what kind of legacy they've left behind. I'm joined in the studio today by Vincent Feeney, the author of Burlington, A History of Vermont's Queen City, and Finnegan's Slaters and Stonepeggers, A History of the Irish in Vermont, and Jeffrey Potash. He's the co-author of Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont. Gentlemen, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thank you, Nina.
So, first of all, let's go way back. When did the very first Native American settlers come to the area, as far as we know? Jeff Potash, do we know what drove them here?
I hadn't prepared for that, but let's go with it. Early on, we're estimating somewhere around 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, there is evidence of Clovis settlements in Vermont. Which indicates, as throughout America, the progression of peoples across the continent. Much more pronounced, obviously, as we move into the last 1,500 to 2,000 years, where we begin to see a much more substantial number of people and more permanent settlements. And much of the work that's been done geologically in terms of analyzing particular settings seems to focus on a large-scale population of people who are probably here 1,500 years ago or so.
Wow. Well, I'm going to jump ahead then through history after the American Revolution as Vermont headed into the 1800s. I understand the state's population growth slowed way down. Many farms were being abandoned. A lot of the old growth timber had been cut down, and some even described the state as kind of worn out. And I'm wondering what was going on at that time in Vermont and how attractive a place was it to live for folks back then? Jeff, I'll go back to you for that one.
Well, again, this really, I hope, sets up Vince's conversation of the first, significant non-European immigrants who come in the 1830s and the 1840s, that being the Irish. Prior to that, we see predominantly Europeans, English-speaking folks coming from the settled portions of New England after the Civil War or just prior to the Civil War, largely because populations throughout New England are expanding dramatically. And of course, those populations are grounded in subsistence farming. Land is fundamental. So throughout, the early story of Vermont in the 1770s and 80s essentially is a contest to see who can come in and acquire substantial pieces of property. Along with that mindset is the mindset that property being so pervasive and available can be at some level misused. And so, when one looks at the early farming, believe it or not, we were originally growing wheat in Vermont. When we exhaust the land's capacity to grow wheat, we shift to any number of other crops. And then eventually in the 18 teens and 20s, when we've exhausted a good portion of our primary agricultural resources, we simply shift to grazing, initially with the sheep craze in the 1830s and 1840s, and subsequently, when that falters in the 1850s, to dairying. But what's critically important from your perspective is this idea that over time, farming, which had traditionally been one which brought large numbers of subsistence farmers to Vermont, gradually became, as properties were exhausted and farms were consolidated, fewer and fewer people needed to run larger and larger farms. And so we see significant depopulation of rural villages in Vermont as early as the 1830s and 40s.
So, Vince Feeney, when did the number of immigrants from outside the rest of the country start entering Vermont? When did that start to pick up?
Well, I guess we could say that the French Canadians had always been here from the very beginning. I mean, you have at about the time of the American Revolution, you have a character by the name of, and I may mispronounce this, Mallet or Ballet, who's got a little homestead right at what is today Mallet's Bay in Lake Champlain. And there was always a trickle of French Canadians that would come down. But the first real kind of large scale group of, I guess we'll call them foreigners, was probably the Irish beginning after the War of 1812, when you begin to have a fair amount of immigration to North America. And a lot of those Irish came to North America through Canada. And of course, it was easy access to just come right up the Richelieu River and to Lake Champlain and settle in Vermont. And as Jeff was alluding to, you had a lot of old Yankee farmers leaving this area because it's not the easiest place to farm, right? A lot of rocky soil and lands out in the Ohio and so on looked much better. So it was fairly easy for Irish immigrants to pick up a farm, or they could go to work in the quarries that were beginning to be developed 1830s, 1840s, particularly down in Rutland, but around the state. And then, of course, with the famine, the Great Potato Famine of the 1840s, you just have a flood of Irish coming in. And so the Irish become the largest immigrant group, preceding really the French Canadians, who were going to come in great numbers in the 1860s.
Listeners, do you know when your ancestors came to Vermont? And what do you know of their experience here? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a comment on Vermont Edition's Facebook page or at vpr.net. I want to follow up on that, the potato famine issue, in a little bit, in a few minutes, because I think there were a number of big pressing events that pushed immigrants our way, and that's probably one that many people have heard about. But before we talk about what was pushing immigrants out of their home country, I want to talk a little bit about just the journey, because I find it pretty mind-boggling that people could, early in the 1800s, mid-1800s, and into the 1900s, get on a boat, leave everything they knew behind, and not even know if they're going to make it safely to this new world. So I'm wondering, what do we know about the journey, and was there something going on with transportation in the mid-1800s that made that journey easier, cheaper, safer? Do either of you know?
Well, I don't know if it made it easier. Anything made it easier. I mean, those trips across the Atlantic, at least in the early 19th century, I mean, this would be a 6-week, 7-week voyage, and it was very scary. I think it just underlines how driven these people were to escape the background, the situation that they found themselves in.
Certainly in the latter part of the 19th century, I mean, what you're looking at is the appearance of the steamship and the tremendous increase ultimately in traffic moving across the ocean, both in terms of people and produce. As far as that exchange is concerned, I know, again, from the Jewish experience with which I'm familiar in Burlington in the 1870s and 80s, they're coming on cattle boats, and passage is cheap. And basically, they have very, very little. They've bribed their way out of contested lands, and they've managed to get to Hamburg, or one of the great ports, and very cheaply they can get themselves to Castle Rock, to New York.
I want to read something that we came across. It's an article about immigration to Vermont by historian Elise Guillette. She wrote about a Welsh immigrant named William Hughes who arrived in Fairhaven in 1853. She writes, after 7 weeks of a stormy voyage in steerage, 2 days in New York, an all-night boat ride to Albany, and a train trip into Fairhaven, this gentleman finally remembers coming into, and this is where the gentleman's journal picks up, a small, insignificant station at Fairhaven. But I knew that I was in a new world, very different from the old Welsh world. The sky was clear blue and the sun in its zenith. The weather was wonderfully warm. I remember how proud I was to tread again on the grass green or the green grass, to breathe the fresh air, to smell the fragrance of the flowers, and see the inexhaustible clover on the sides of the road. But soon dark clouds came over us. In 6 weeks, my little brother, about 1 year old, died. He'd been ill during the journey from Wales, and this caused a great heartache for my mother for a long time. And I thought that passage really painted, you know, this interesting contrast between this beautiful new world that showed so much promise and yet the heartache and the price this particular family paid to get there.
Well, and you know, you could speak, I'm sure, to the Irish in the 1830s and 1840s. I mean, the Welsh are coming to Fairhaven because they're Slaters, and they're being, as Vermont, again, part of the change that's transpiring in the 1850s and 60s with the quarrying trade, you know, are being solicited because they have experiences and because their homelands essentially are suffering from overpopulation. So they're willing you know, to subject themselves to that extraordinary travel that you describe.
Yeah. And the tragedy of the young person dying not many weeks after arriving in the New World is very similar with the Irish situation. You know, the ships that came across the Atlantic in the 1840s were lumber ships that had brought Canadian lumber to the British Isles and had previously been deadheading back. So just as Jeff alluded to a minute ago, how they were ships that were cargo ships that would take on passengers, they really weren't fitted out. And so many Irish died of typhus. It was called ship fever. It was so common. Thousands were buried at sea. And there's an island up just north of Quebec City called Gros Isle that was a quarantine station. And in the summer of 1847, there were 5,000 Irish buried there. So it was a horrendous voyage. Obviously, when steamships come in and become much more common later in the century, as Jeff said, it becomes a little bit easier. But it was still, I wonder, or I always contemplate how courageous these people were to pull up stakes and everything that they'd really known at home. Even if the situation was bad, it was still home. It was what they knew, right? And to just kind of jump out into this strange new world that they don't know much about. It's amazing what they went through.
It's mind-boggling. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the ways immigration came into Vermont in the 1800s and early 1900s, how it shaped Vermont and boosted the state's population and diversity. Vince Feeney, author of Burlington, A History of Vermont's Queen City, and Finnegan's, Slaters, and Stonepeggers, A History of the Irish in Vermont, is one of my guests. I'm also joined by Jeff Potash, co-author of Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211, or post a question or a comment. Maybe you can tell us about your families on our Facebook page or at vpr.net. So typically, Vince Feeney, what would happen to those people, those Irish that you mentioned, when they got off the boat in the U.S.? Was there any process that they had to go through, and did they have to prove they had a job waiting for them?
No, they didn't have to prove much of anything, except the fact that they were healthy. That was probably the biggest hurdle that they would face. But, I mean, the borders were very porous. I mean, those the ones that came in through Canada virtually just walked across the border or came down on boats. And the same is true with the ones that came into New York City. The big question is, of course, how did they get to Vermont, the ones that came into New York City? And my guess is, you know, they may have had a relative or a neighbor from their previous existence who was already here in Vermont. And this would be true of, I think, of all ethnic groups. You know, sociologists and historians talk about chain migration, right? Once you have one, you know, friend or relative in an area, then the word gets out and someone was probably writing home to Poland or to wherever saying, you know, there's work in the quarries here or in the textile mills. And, you know, if they could make it to New York, again, you know, they might have had just enough money to get on the train, right, in the second half of the 19th century to get up to Vermont. And of course, the textile, there's a lot of laboring jobs at that time. There's kind of a mini industrial revolution going on.
I wanted to ask you about that. I read in the 1820s, I think that's when Thaddeus Fairbanks, who had patented his famous platform scale, created the E&T Fairbanks Company, which employed a lot of French Canadians and other immigrants. Then you had Redfield Proctor, who was turning Rutland into sort of one of the marble capitals of the world. And there was the Springfield tool industry. Jeff Potash, talk about how employers of those major industries in Vermont attracted immigrants. Were they actively recruiting? Would they go down to New York and solicit people coming off the boats?
It really depends upon the particular circumstance. Early on, I mean, when we're looking at the Irish, correct me if I'm mistaken, but the Irish essentially are drawn to Vermont in the 1830s and 40s in large numbers owing to the construction of the railroad. And so you need large numbers of workers. Now, there, as you can well imagine, you see it subsequently with the Chinese laborers who are needed to build the railroads out west. There's a tremendous perception that there's something fundamentally wrong with this. Vince has written extensively. I mean, the Catholics are not welcome in Vermont in the 1830s and 1840s. We're still largely a Protestant state, and subsequently, there are great numbers of people who question, the wisdom of bringing in laborers. Who, God forbid, might stay. And the Irish do stay initially, within the railroad towns, within the Burlingtons and the Northfields and St. Albans and so forth and so on. But again, as Vince has written, and they begin to see that this is a source of opportunity, they begin to draw others, and the like. So they're not solicited. They're thought of as temporary labor. When you get to the mills in the 1860s, then you begin a very conscious outreach to the French Canadians in Quebec, because at that juncture, it's a consequence initially of the Civil War, when the mills are producing huge amounts of wares, and subsequently in the years thereafter, you need labor. And subsequently, those people are brought in much the same fashion as Redfield Proctor for marble, as the Berry granite industry, and as the Fairhaven slate industry. Fairhaven, reaches out to the Welsh, the Italians.
Well, and you are talking about how the Irish were brought in and many worked on the railroads and helped with that industry. Employers often hired immigrants, it seems, for specific jobs or skills based on ethnicity. Vince Feeney, how pigeonholed were people? If you were Irish, was that the only place you could get a job? Or if you were Polish, were you limited to certain jobs? Were people fairly pigeonholed?
I think initially that was true. I mean, you look at the industries that existed. I mean, railroading became, at least the laboring part of railroading became, for probably 20 years or so, in the middle of the 19th century, almost an Irish monopoly. I've seen in the census records, I'll come across a work crew in Georgia, Vermont. There might be 100 men, and they're all Irish. Now, later on, that changes. As the Irish worked up the socioeconomic scale, if you begin to look at railroad crews in the 1880s, 1890s, they tend to be Italians. Huh. So, there is kind of a shuffling of people into certain categories. In the textile mills, it's primarily, not exclusively, but primarily young French-Canadian women working in the textile mills. And again, I think a lot of this has to do with, similar to chain migration. Someone's sister gets a job in the textile mills and says, oh, I can get you in too. They need weavers or something like that. The Welsh had a history of working in slate in Wales, so they tended to gravitate towards that. The Italians, of course, are recruited. I mean, besides kind of the laboring and the railroads, right? They go to the granite quarries in Barry, beginning in the 1880s, and then of course in the marble, they replaced the Irish in the marble quarries in the 1880s in the Rutland area. So there was that kind of pigeonholing in a way.
Listeners, 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about immigration, how it impacted the state of Vermont's makeup today, and what sort of legacy all these different immigrant groups have had on the state. Let's take a call now from Chester. David is on the line. Hi, David. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have two related questions. A while ago, they mentioned that it was very cheap to get on one of these boats. I was wondering if they could tell us what the price is and relate that to modern-day dollars. How expensive would it be for someone to do it? And the second question is, in light of the refugee situation in Europe right now, crossing the Mediterranean, with people smuggling people across the Mediterranean, how did people view the companies that were bringing across people across the Atlantic? Were they reputable or disreputable?
All right, let me throw that those two questions to my guest today, David. Thanks for the question. First of all, on price, do either of you know what it might have cost these immigrant families to come to the U.S.?
The only thing I could say in relation to price is that from all the records, it was very, very low. But, you know, whether it was $2 or something. One of the things that was happening with Canada is Britain was encouraging immigrants out of the British Isles in the early 19th century to go to Canada, I think because it was in the British interest to populate that huge country. So they had very low tariffs on tickets, that is passenger ship tickets, going from the British Isles to Canada, as opposed to very high tariffs going to the United States. So it was simply cheaper to go to British North America and then to come into Vermont, in our case here. There was a second part of the question here, and I've lost it here.
He was talking about kind of comparing some of the disreputable modes of traffic for refugees in Europe right now. I think comparing that, wondering how that was 100 years ago.
What's interesting, you know, again, I mean, we're talking around sort of the modern day issue, which is sort of the push-pull dynamics of immigration. I mean, are people being pushed out of countries and subsequently are they trying to find just some place of refuge, or are they being pulled, being drawn? You know, Vermont in the various waves experiences both. I think early on when one speaks, you know, for instance, to the Irish in the 1830s and 40s, they're being pushed out, you know, of Ireland very clearly as a consequence of the dramatic set of circumstances there. They're coming to Vermont and they're discovering a place that's changing as a consequence of the railroads, as a consequence of the industrialization that's transpiring. I mean, bear in mind, in 1840, the largest town in Vermont is Burlington, and I think it's under 4,000 people. Urbanization in Vermont begins in the 1840s and progresses really up through the continuation of the 19th century. All the while, we're talking about depopulation of rural communities, farm communities that, you know, beginning in the 1840s and 1850s, begin gradually to lose populations. Great fun looking at census records and discovering all these little tiny Vermont towns scattered across our area that had much larger populations in the 1830s and 40s than they do today. So, as a consequence of the dramatic change in the character of Vermont, the urbanization process, I think you begin to see, you know, as you've been talking about, and certainly the Burlington book speaks to, is that there's a tremendous need for workers, for laborers. I mean, initially in Burlington in the 1850s with the railroad in the 60s, it's lumber. But gradually, you know, begin to see huge populations of people coming to Burlington and other centers to undertake industrial jobs. What I would simply add, you know, which we're wrestling with today, is the notion of the Vermont identity. And you have to bear in mind, in the 1840s, when the Irish came here to begin with, the Vermont Historical Society was founded on the grounds that the question was, who are we? What's our identity? And are we losing it? So what we conceive of in, you know, in modern times with being a phenomena that perhaps is unprecedented is really one of several waves in which we begin to look at the fact that people are coming to us who are different. People are leaving in the form of farmers and children of people who are looking for jobs elsewhere. And I think the cycle continues.
All right. We'll continue our discussion on immigration in just a minute after a short break. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Between 1870 and 1910, the percentage of Vermont's population that was foreign-born swelled to 14%. It's the highest it's ever been in this state. Today, only about 4% of Vermont's population is foreign-born, much lower than the national average of about 13%. Today on the program, we're talking about the various immigrant groups that have made their way to Vermont over the last 200 or so years and how their traditions, beliefs, and cultures have changed the state. I'm joined in the studio by Jeffrey Potash, co-author of Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont, and Vince Feeney, author of Burlington, A History of Vermont's Queen City, and Finnegan, Slaters, and Stonepeggers, A History of the Irish in Vermont. Listeners, you can join us by calling 1-800-639-2211. Let's take a call now from South Woodstock. Jackie is on the line. Hi, Jackie. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi. I'm calling on behalf of my husband's family. And the situation is a little bit different. His grandmother came to Vermont on an orphan train out of Boston.
Wow.
She was a Sicilian immigrant. And I just wondered if either one of your commentators had anything on any potential impact that something like an orphan train might have had on population.
Thanks for the call, Jackie. Fascinating. Do either of you have any background on the orphan train?
Nina, I have heard just rumblings about that from Catholic immigrant groups, because I think what was happening is in some of our great eastern seaboard cities like Boston, New York City, is you would have youngsters coming, or because of the difficult passage, became orphans by the time they arrived, and the church would kind of take them in, but then look to farm them out into areas that they thought, that is the church thought, were healthier, more conducive to a youngster's upbringing, rather than living in the Five Corners in New York City.
Wow.
Which was a tough neighborhood. And I know I've heard stories of some of them coming up here to Vermont. You'd find a childless couple that were willing to take a youngster in, and I don't know if it was a whole train of youngsters. It might have been one or two at a time coming up to stay with and be adopted eventually by a Vermont family.
I want to ask you about, in the 1880s, Vermont governor at the time, William Dillingham, started an immigrant recruiting effort aimed at bringing more Northern Europeans to Vermont. And it was decided the effort would target Swedes, as I understand it. And I'm wondering, why Swedes? Jeff Potash, you're nodding your head that you know what I'm talking about. What was that program all about, and how'd it go?
So again, in terms of the idea of who you'd like to come and who you don't like. In the 1880s, Vermont is being significantly impacted by large numbers of Eastern European refugees who are coming here with very little and who functionally are very much different than the existing population. As a consequence, the notion of Vermont's identity, appears at times in a productive way, more often than not in a very ugly way. Dillingham, for instance, much like Justin Morrill, is very anti-Irish, very anti-Italian. Dillingham speaks to defective people in the 1880s when he's referring to populations of people who he thinks do not fit the Vermont identity. The Swedes, then, are a perfect counterpoint. And he actually goes out in three small rural villages, Vershire, Whittingham, and I've forgotten the third, and says, look, here are exhausted farms. Start them up. And at some level, he's thinking that that will sort of reconstruct the golden days when we didn't have that diversity and the problems that he thought accompanied that diversity.
Yeah. Wow.
The Welsh were another group that were preferred. You actually saw the slate companies in the Fairhaven, West Castleton area recruit from Wales and also in Vershire in the copper mines up there, because the Welsh had a history of being miners. And number two, they're Protestants. They're Methodists, right? And so, rather than bringing in more Catholics, you want to bring in Finns who were or Swedes who were Lutherans or Swedenborg, or you want to bring in Methodists, right? They're good stock as opposed to these—
And just
less
to,
reputable.
Just to make it even more complicated, I mean, don't forget, in the 1880s, it's the heyday of the temperance movement, the Women's Christian Temperance League. It's the heyday of any number of nationalist, very nationalist organizations that again are arguing for the identity of Vermont and the fact that we need to preserve and protect.
I want to briefly touch on, as we're running a little bit out of time, and I wanted to make sure and talk about the Irish potato famine, just because that was such a big deal, and you hear about that being such a big cause effect for the flooding of immigrants. You're nodding your head. Vince Feeney, briefly tell us when and what encompassed or when that famine occurred and how bad it was?
Well, the peak years of the Irish potato famine, and one must understand that most Irish people, probably 80% of the population, were peasants. They weren't landowners, right? They worked a little plot of land. They gave the wheat crop, the cash crop, went to the landlord, who more often than not was a member of the Anglo-Irish aristocracy, right? And so what the Irish lived on was this crop that originally came from South America, right? The potato, because it's called the lazy root. It's very easy to raise, right? And that was mainly what the Irish people ate. Well, in the years 1845, 1846, and then again in 1848, the crop failed 3 years in a row. Well, not in a row, but in those 3 years. And people simply starved to death. And anyone who could get out did so, right? And even some good landlords, right, actually gave money to transport people to North America. There's a good case of that. Actually, there's a whole crowd of Irish that went to Rutland who came from one area in Ireland, their passage paid by landlords. But there were very few, you know, good landlords like that. And they had to get out. I mean, they were true refugees, people seeking to survive.
Right? Well, I want to give the last word on that refugee issue because I'm curious, Jeff Potash, what your thoughts are as you look at the concerns over refugees in Rutland. You know, we haven't really talked about that during this discussion, but briefly put that in a perspective, what you make of that with just looking at our immigration patterns.
Again, I mean, what we need to bear in mind is that Vermont has this heyday during which time it's fairly homogeneous up until the 1830s with the arrival of the Irish and the French Canadians in the 1840s through 60s, subsequent Eastern Europeans in the 1870s through the turn of the century. We begin to experience dramatic changes, you know, in the character of Vermont's population. There's a certain tension associated with that, and yet one of the most endearing pieces I find is a sociologist at UVM, Ellen Anderson, who says in her book in 1935, "We Americans are immigrants, assimilate. We change them to the same degree that they change us."
Gentlemen, fascinating discussion. Thank you both very much for being in the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nina.
Jeffrey Potash is co-author of Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont. Vincent Feeney is the author of Burlington, A History of Vermont's Queen City and Finnegan's, Slaters and Stonepeggers, A History of the Irish on Vermont. More to come. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Over the past few years, state officials and forest biologists have been very worried about a couple of invasive pests that have been encroaching on our landscape. The emerald ash borer beetle and the hemlock woody adelgid are probably species you didn't grow up hearing about, but certainly you know the names now. A new paper suggests that the U.S. needs to be doing more to fight the spread of invasive forest pests before our landscape is changed irrevocably. VPR's Jane Lindholm recently spoke with Matthew Ayers, a Dartmouth College biologist who studies the population biology of forest insects.
In this paper that you've co-authored with other researchers from the U.S. and Canada, I mean, you don't pull any punches. You say right in the beginning that the most serious and urgent near-term ecological threat for many U.S. forests and trees is invasive pests. And you say the damage from these pests is already likely measured in the billions of dollars per year, mostly falling on homeowners, property owners, and municipalities. Why are invasive pests such a problem in this country?
Partly because there are so many of them flooding into our country and other countries around the world. It's associated with global trade and global commerce. When we move species from one part of the world to another, lots of times not much happens. Lots of times they simply fail to establish a population. But some percentage of those that do get established are able to escape from the forces that may have limited their abundance in their native environment, or in some cases, they're pests in their native environment, and not surprisingly, they're also pests when they get to another continent. A special problem is with non-natives is that you run the risk of extirpating whole plant species. or bringing them, decimating populations, bringing them to even the range of possibilities includes what we call functional extinction. And unfortunately, that's the pathway we're headed down for ash trees in North America. And that will probably be more or less done within another one or two decades.
You state in the paper that the emerald ash borer beetle, which is the cause of this extirpation of ash trees, is the costliest and most destructive forest insect to invade North America to date. And you say it could cost $12.7 billion through 2020. But you actually list 18 species, non-native forest insects and pathogens in North America that you say have a current or potential future high impact. Can you name a couple of the other ones that people may or may not have heard of?
There's the hemlock woolly adelgid, which is now probably established in southern Vermont and New Hampshire. This is from Asia, and it's an insect that feeds by sucking on the, it's got a piercing, sucking mouth part that it uses to suck on the leaf cells of hemlock trees. And it turns out that it is lethal to eastern hemlock. Another one people may not have heard of, there's a winter moth, became established on Cape Cod, that's now become more widespread in Massachusetts and is expanding north and west. This is a notorious forest pest. It's a defoliator. The caterpillars eat leaves, defoliate trees like cherry trees, apple trees, and it can kill trees. It's also a pest in its native range, and that also is expanding into New England forests. Those are a few. As you say, the list goes on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty extensive list. And some of them are ones people will have heard of, like the hemlock woolly adelgid. And some of them are, you know, new to me, at least the red bay ambrosia beetle and fungus I didn't know about, for example.
Oh, the red bay ambrosia beetle is a great one. Yes, that's that is now introduced in the southeastern U.S. And there's a plant called the red bay. It's in the same family that includes avocados and sassafras and spice bush. And this beetle, along with its mutualistic fungus, seems to be almost 100% lethal on red bay. Red bay is the source of bay leaves in the spice section of your grocery store.
And just to be clear on what you were looking at in this paper, you're looking at insects and pathogens that are not from North America. You're not looking at native species that are moving within North America, moving their ranges perhaps because of climate change. And you're looking specifically at the impacts on forests and trees, but not on crops that are primarily grown for agricultural purposes like orchards. But your look would include things like you just mentioned, the bay leaves, or things like maple trees, which do have a high economic and agricultural value in a place like New England.
Yes, and you're right that the problem is bigger than non-native pests. So range expansions of native insects is another factor which is rocking the forests of New England. So even now, southern pine beetle, which is native to the southeastern U.S. and is one of the most aggressive tree-killing insects in the world, has now expanded its range into New Jersey, more recently Long Island, and last year there were trap captures of this species in northwestern Massachusetts, 90 minutes south of where I live.
So why is the Northeast and the Upper Midwest the biggest area that's threatened by these non-native species, though? You mentioned that these are the two areas that are at greatest risk.
New England is a global hotspot for a diversity of invasive insects. There are about 50 non-native forest insects that we know of in New Hampshire, Vermont, goes up to 60 or so if you add New York and Maine. And there are a few reasons for this. One of them is certainly that the eastern seaboard, New York City, for example, is a global commerce hub. And so lots and lots of trade comes in, including lots of things that are packed on wooden pallets. And those wooden pallets are one of the main ways that some of these insects get transmitted between continents. Also, the forests are quite diverse. And so that makes it more likely that when some random insect arrives from somewhere else in the world, that it's going to find in our forest some tree species which is closely enough related to what it normally feeds on that it recognizes it as a host and is able to consume and reproduce on it. And sometimes those native North American plants lack the defenses that they need in order to control the damage. That's the case with the ash. So the global commerce, the high diversity forests, and then global warming or the climatic warming that's been occurring in our region in the last 50 years, the coldest night of the winter on average is about 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it was 50 years ago. Previously, there were many insects that would arrive in these ports and then die in their first winter. Now the climate is becoming more benign, so the number of ports which a non-native insect might be able to establish from is becoming greater and extending farther into our region.
You mentioned that many of these invasive pests are coming in within the wood packaging on that are then carried on ships and introduced into U.S. ports. And the two main ways that these pests are getting in are through this packaging or through live plants that are brought in for horticultural purposes.
There's an enormous number of woody plants that get shipped into the U.S. to be sold here. And those are it's very, very challenging. When you're shipping that material around, to be absolutely sure that they're pest-free.
Well, you say that there are policies in place that are having a positive effect on pests and are, in some cases, doing some good to control pests. But absent new, more effective policies, we are going to be seeing severe damage. They're just not keeping pace with the invasives that are coming in. So what do you think can or should be done that isn't being done?
There are a handful of very simple and sensible things that can be done. They're probably going to require legislation, but they include switching to non-solid wood packaging to get away from these wood pallet problems. And we have the technology to do that. Another is to become better at detecting pests early when they've just arrived. So expanding early detection and rapid response programs. If we catch these things when they're still at low numbers, we're sometimes able to extirpate them. Once they become widely established, extirpating them is usually an impossibility. Another is to augment international pest prevention programs with key trade partners. We can come up with agreements by working with our key trade partners to develop practices that will lower these risks. Right now, it isn't really anybody's job to do that. Restrict the imports of live woody plants is also an obvious one.
Well, in the paper, you're talking about these large-scale ways to do it, but it seems like those are a couple of ways that regular Joes like you and me can also help is doing things like if the rule says don't carry firewood from one state to another, don't do it.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, friends don't let friends move firewood around. This is one of the main ways that pests get transmitted within a country once they become established. My suggestion would be that the real benefits to this are going to go to tens of thousands, millions of individual homeowners, landowners, and members of local governments, because that's where these costs are coming down. What happens when your town suddenly has to spend $1 million in the next 2 years to cut down hazard trees, which are otherwise going to be falling on houses and power lines and cars? Where do those millions of dollars come from? Well, they come out of the school budget, the road maintenance. And so if enough of us contact our legislators and ask them, what are you doing to prevent the next Emerald Ash Borer? I think that lots of things can be made to happen.
Well, Professor Ayers, thank you very much for telling us about your research and your paper. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Ayers is a professor of biological sciences at Dartmouth College, and he's co-author of a new open-source paper on the threat of invasive forest pests and how the U.S. might better prevent their spread. We've got a link to that paper at vpr.net. It's primary election day in Vermont, so tomorrow we'll get a recap of the results from today's voting, and we'll hear from the winning candidates in the two gubernatorial primaries and the winner of the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor. Send your questions or comments about today's results to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Liam Connors directed the program. And our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.